The Claude 3 model family by Anthropic is your one-stop shop for enterprise AI. Haiku is lightning fast and cost effective. Sonnet strikes the perfect balance between skills and speed. And Opus sets new industry benchmarks for intelligence. Learn more at anthropic.com/Claude.
I'm Linda Fairstein. I'm a former prosecutor in New York City and the author of a series of crime novels featuring prosecutor Alexandra Cooper. The job required a fortitude that I wasn't sure I had, but grew into it. It was such an honor to fight for the people, whether they were the victim survivors, whether they were the police detectives who had not had these cases move through the system successfully. So I became that strengthened young woman in a non-traditional role and very much wanted to portray that in my crime novels.
This is Secrets of Wealthy Women from the Wall Street Journal, helping women empower themselves financially. Now, Veronica Dagger.
Linda Fairstein is a best-selling author and was chief of the Sex Crimes Unit of the District Attorney's Office in Manhattan for over 20 years, which went on to inspire Law & Order SVU. She discusses her evolution from sex crimes prosecutor to novelist. So, Linda, you wanted to be a writer since you were a girl, but your dad discouraged you. Tell us about that.
I always loved books and wanted to be in that world. My father, who was quite supportive and wonderful, used to roll his eyes as I'm smiling at you and say, you have nothing to write about. Get a career. So I didn't think he was right until the end of my college years as an English lit major and realized I really didn't have a way to support myself.
Until later on.
Yes, yes.
You were one of a handful of female prosecutors in New York City when you first started. What was that like?
It was so strange to reflect back now, the 45 years ago at that period of time. I went to an all-women's college, which sort of prepared you to think you could do anything. I got to law school in 1969. It was still a very all-male world, like many professions, like journalism, like medicine. So it was kind of shocking to then be one of a dozen women in a law school class of 300 and find that a lot of doors were closed to me. Criminal trial work was one of the very closed worlds. It was really a male-dominated profession, but the feminist movement had worked enough to sort of kick open some doors, and the Manhattan District Attorney was taking basically one woman a year in the entering class. I was lucky enough to be that woman in 1972.
How did you not get frustrated?
It was enormously frustrating to find that doors were closed. It was, you know, part of it, as I look back, was just youth and thinking you can do everything. Okay, if this door is shut, I'll turn left. I'm well educated. I've got people who believe in me. I've got a very understanding family. It was when I started to work and realized in how many professions and then in my own handling really sexual assault as a specialty, the laws were so archaic that it was not only frustrating, it was painful to meet women every day of the week who had horrible things happen to them and literally could not get inside a courtroom because of our laws.
What was one of the most outrageous laws that used to exist?
Okay, the most outrageous was called corroboration, and we inherited it from the Brits, so it was really a thing of the 17th century in England. It required of a rape victim that there be independent evidence. In other words, her word was not enough. She could say, I was robbed at knife point, but she needed independent proof of who the rapist was, what kind of force he used. And when I say medical evidence, I'm talking about a time many of your listeners now know about rape evidence collection kits. They see the issues on popular TV shows and fiction. They didn't exist at the time. There were really no units, no sexual assault nurse examiners, forensic examiners. So getting all of these things in one case, all of this supporting evidence, was next to impossible.
You were one of the first prosecutors in the country to use DNA evidence in trying sex crimes. How did that change things for victims?
It's revolutionary. I there's no word strong enough to sort of describe what it did. I was introduced to DNA in 1986. That was when it began to be used forensically. No judge in the country allowed its use till 1989. So in probably my highest profile case that some of your listeners will remember or know of, Robert Chambers, remembers the Preppy murder case in 1986. Robert killed a young woman friend of his, Jennifer Levin, in Central Park. And the medical examiner said to me, there's a new science. We can use DNA in investigating this case. And in fact, it was DNA that linked the murder weapon, clothing used to suffocate Jennifer Levin, to Robert Chambers. But we were never allowed to let a jury hear that. Terribly, terribly frustrating, to borrow your word back. And so from that point on, what DNA allowed us to do, both to exonerate people wrongly accused and certainly to confirm identifications, to confirm in cases we've had blind victims, blindfolded victims, people who could never, because of darkness or circumstances, identify their attacker. And DNA takes all the guesswork out of it and makes it a positive identification. So it's really changed the criminal justice system in ways I could never have imagined.
Given what you've seen and know, how do you sleep at night?
My mother used to wonder that. You know, it seems like such a dark world. And for me, I arrived at a moment in the 70s when we were just being able to shed light on it, when we changed these archaic laws, when a decade later I was introduced to DNA, when women began to come forward more regularly to trust the criminal justice system. So I think for me, it was working with victims and being able to get them justice, which was an impossibility at the time I got to the DA's office. I was very lucky to be there when changes became possible and to jump on those possibilities and move them forward. And I think sleeping at night really became a product of giving victims some way to triumph in the system, not to erase what happened, obviously.
What do you say to people who say a woman is asking to be sexually assaulted because of what she's wearing?
That is one of the oldest arguments that usually gets a very good rise out of me. I answer you calmly now, but it's really absurd to think that this happened, that this crime happens because of the way a woman presents herself socially, how she's dressed. Sometimes, obviously, it makes it easier for an assailant to overtake her and rip her clothes off or force her clothes off. Generally, historically, rates of sexual assault have always gone up in warm weather, in part because people are out longer hours, later hours, and in part because they may not be wearing winter coats and boots and things that make it harder for a rapist to complete what he's doing. But that's his fault, not the victim's.
You said women don't understand the hazard of staying at a bar alone. What do you mean by that?
I have had so many cases, my colleagues have had so many cases that occur not because the victim is drunk, but because she is made so much more vulnerable by anything like alcohol, like drugs, that causes her awareness to be impaired and her ability to respond to be impaired. So I think of a period in the 80s when there was a lot of attention to this issue and young women began to talk about, very intelligently, using a buddy system, going out together, and three young women would be drinking. I'm thinking of how many cases I had at Columbia University in the West End Bar up on Broadway, which was a classic location. When it was time to go, two young women might be ready to go, and the third had met somebody and wanted to stay. And the buddy system kind of went out the window. And I just have seen so many young women hurt irreparably by drinking, which is their right to do, drinking to excess, which may be their right, but not always the most sensible thing to do when alone, and then going out onto the street, being vulnerable to people who've either followed them from the bar, but certainly strangers who are on the street and encounter them.
Your office oversaw the Central Park jogger case. After spending years in prison, the Central Park Five were exonerated. What do you think about that?
I think that you're going to see some new reporting, an investigative report that's coming up. They were only exonerated by one person who in my old office, and actually the corporation counsel, Zachary Carter, who's an African-American man and a lawyer, told me he believed the police and prosecutors did nothing wrong in this case and believes that the five actually assaulted the other six victims who were viciously assaulted in the park that night, including a teacher, 41-year-old New York City school teacher, whose head was split open by one of the five carrying the same weapon that we believe split the jogger's head open. So I don't think we've heard the end of that case yet.
You said some people initially brushed you off when you said you wanted to write books. How did you not get discouraged that time?
Well, I think that really goes back to my childhood dreams of wanting to write. And it was something that carried on all through my young adult life. And when I was asked to write a nonfiction book about sort of the groundbreaking work we had done, then when that was finished in 93 and published, I went back to the district attorney and said, I've always wanted to write fiction, crime fiction, in fact. May I do that? And he and the city ethics board said, sure, as long as you do it on your own time, which my husband liked to call his time. So it was Saturdays and Sundays. It was early mornings. I'd get up at 5 and try and write for 2 hours before I went to work. It just was something that I wasn't going to let go of till I tried to do it. Of course, I thought one of the things I was doing in the 90s when I began the series was writing about a world that I had entered, which was a woman in a non-traditional role as a prosecutor. And happily, I say, those days are over, as you know from TV news and TV fiction and crime novels. Women now hold many of these jobs, all of these jobs. So I started writing, and I'm now midstream on my 20th Alex Cooper novel. So it's been a great joy for me to fulfill that childhood dream.
The Claude 3 model family from Anthropic is your one-stop shop for enterprise AI. With models at every point on the price-performance curve, you no longer have to make trade-offs between intelligence, speed, and cost. Claude 3 Opus sets new industry benchmarks for intelligence. Sonnet strikes the perfect balance between skills and speed. And Haiku is the fastest and lowest-cost model on the market, perfectly designed for high-volume, high-speed use cases. Join the thousands of enterprises who trust Anthropic to keep them at the frontier. Visit anthropic.com/Claude today.
The Future of Everything podcast from the Wall Street Journal. Another new episode is coming soon as we look at science, technology, and their influence on our lives. The Future of Everything podcast from the Wall Street Journal. The future is closer than you think. You're listening to Secrets of Wealthy Women from the Wall Street Journal.
What's your advice to women who want to do a major career change?
My advice is to give it a lot of thought, talk to people you trust in either or both aspects of the change, and do it. I think one of the things that I hear most from people approaching my age are regrets about choices not made and things they didn't do but wanted to do. And I think it's easy to get into a, not so much a rut maybe, but a routine of doing something that becomes comfortable, but you've got your eye on something else all the time. I didn't give up the day job, as we say, prosecuting till I was 5 novels in, but I'm thrilled that I made the transition.
You were writing a strong female character before it became mainstream. Was that a risk?
That's funny. I was writing a strong mainstream character. I was anything but that character. My dentist asked me the other day, he said, how did you get to be that person from your background? And other people can tell you how that change happened. I was put in this role. We tried to make changes. I was a fairly shy, not aggressive, not out to burn bridges and bras and other things that young feminists were doing then. I just wanted this job and wanted to do it well. So the job required a fortitude that I wasn't sure I had, but grew into it. It was such an honor to fight for the people, whether they were the victim survivors, whether they were the police detectives who had not had these cases move through the system successfully. So I became that strengthened young woman in a non-traditional role and very much wanted to portray that in my crime novels.
Your main character, Alex Cooper, talks back to authority. What's your advice to women who want to challenge authority?
Well, one can read I Know Where You Are in the series, which is the later teens of the 19 published books. In the early novels, Alex Cooper did not talk back to her boss very much, and I was still working as a DA when I wrote the first 5 books. So there was interior thought. I know there are lines where she's thinking, boy, would I like to say that, but she didn't dare. So I think she has grown over the years of writing and my different perspective to talk back a little more than necessary. But I think you go in with a position of trust. And obviously, if there are abuses, if there are things you see that aren't right, I think you find someone, if you can't go to the top, higher up, that you trust to guide you through that kind of situation. Alex gets a little rogue off the reservation here.
Did you face a pay gap as a female writer?
Oh, very interesting. So Mystery Writers of America is a, gosh, it must be 75-year-old organization. And in the 80s, I believe it was Sarah Paretsky and Sue Grafton, the wonderful late Sue Grafton, who banded together and formed Sisters in Crime on the theory, on the fact that women crime writers were being paid less, were being reviewed less frequently than their male counterparts and weren't being published in the numbers that men were. And that's a healthy organization. By the time I came along in the 90s, I was lucky to have kind of early success, helped no doubt more readily than a first-time writer because I had, quote, the real job, unquote, of the character. So there was a lot of interest for that reason. But now I watch so many women writers and young women writers break in. And I don't think that I think people like Grafton and Mary Higgins Clark, whom I adore, and Lisa Gardner and my beloved friend Lisa Scottolini really have broken through all those barriers.
I heard you don't get any money from Law and Order SVU, which Dick Wolf based your unit on. Is that true?
Yeah. So Dick Wolf called me. I didn't know him. He's a genius. And after the main Law and Order had been on, he decided to create Law and Order Special Victims Unit. And we talked. He had the idea. And as I like to say, I think he said it too. He ripped my professional life from the headlines the way he ripped cases and solved them. Kudos to him. It's going on his 20th year. He actually called me to ask if Mariska Hargitay, who is just big smile on my face, just the warmest, loveliest person on this planet, and Stephanie March, who is not a far second, was the first to play the prosecutor on the show, if I'd spend time with them and just kind of coach them through. He had his scripts, Dick Wolf, he had his scripts and his script writers and screenwriters. He never asked me to do that. He took cases from the headlines. He solved them often before we did. He put them on TV with his own fictional endings. And if you had asked me at that time, I did not believe that this subject 20 years ago was really ready for primetime television. I did not think a steady diet of it would have worked, or I might have tried to do it myself. But so no, I don't get any money from it. I get a lot of pleasure and the friendship of Mariska and Stephanie and Chris Maloney. And it's been interesting to watch those shows. But not profitable.
How much time do you spend typically writing every day?
When I'm in the zone, which is when I'm in a hunkered down writing period, the internet's my enemy. When I started writing, there was no email in the late 80s, internet as we know it today. And so now I kind of spend almost an hour chatting with friends, doing a little research, coffee, friends. I really try to get underway by 10 in the morning, work till 1, either take a walk in the summer, swim, do something for exercise and reinvigorating, and try and stay at the keyboard till about 4. By that hour, as you know from writing, either the eyes go or the brain is just mush and start over.
You're often described as well-dressed, which you are today, mentioned as the host of parties for the rich and famous, and speak openly about living in New York and having a home in the vineyard. How did you get comfortable speaking about wealth?
So it's really so odd. I had a very middle class upbringing, no wealth at all, but no material needs. Nobody in my family was materialistic. Took a public service job out of law school. My starting salary was $11,000 back in 72. My law firm friends didn't make all that much more, but proportionally it was a lot. Things have changed since then. My first husband, Justin, was a lawyer, as I say, much older, and he had the house on the vineyard. Not great wealth, but just a really fine and nice life. I obviously made more money writing my first novel than I did probably for 10 years as a prosecutor. And I was married to Justin then. I think I've always been around people who live well. I don't believe in showing it off, whatever, but I've been lucky to be comfortable. I think both my husbands have been incredibly laid back, casual guys. One is understated. Mike would rather be in fly fishing gear than in a tuxedo. And I would be happy in either, but I'm happy to dress up and put the jewels on and go out. So I think not being ostentatious, but sort of being comfortable in your skin is a great place to reach.
Do you have a goal for your finances or your money?
That's so funny because I stayed in the DA's office for 30 years. When I left in 2002, having written 5 books, and really Justin was older and I really wanted to spend time with him, it was the reason I left. But when I left, the salary I was making was lower than the starting salary of someone leaving law school and getting a law firm job, just for perspective. I never was driven by money or doing anything for money. And I think I never had outrageous goals for myself then. My law school friends, and as I say, I was one of the only women in the class. Back in the early days when I was young and single and DA's public servant salary, they'd get the law firm Yankee tickets and the Broadway show tickets, and they'd always include me in those things and the nice dinners. But, you know, I've been fortunate both with my career with novels. I still do consulting, most of it pro bono on cases involving victims, but sometimes I charge for those cases. And Mike's had good success after our law school, after his law school graduation, law career, went into private equity work. So I don't give a lot. I still do my own checkbook, you know. I manage it in that way, and I just learned never to get ahead of myself when I was working on a public service salary, because I think it's a dangerous thing to do. I think it's just important to know how to manage it or get someone's help to manage it.
What's the worst financial advice you ever heard?
Oh, wow. I'd say for me, it's a reverse. The worst advice I had was get out of the DA's office, get out of public service. You're going to get stuck there. You need to make money. Get out in the world. And people said that after 5 years as a prosecutor. I was there 30. It was entirely the reverse for me. One, because I loved what I was doing. Secondly, it turned out to be a springboard for a very successful career as a novelist and consulting work in this field. So doing what I loved turned out to be better than the financial advice that people were telling me not to do.
Time now for your secrets.
I'm Linda Fairstein, former prosecutor in New York City and the author of a series of crime novels. My money secret is to always keep an eye on it, pay my bills, but then find something to splurge on, something that sparkles or looks good.
Look out for upcoming episodes featuring Angie's List founder, Angie Hicks, and TV personality, Wendy Williams. This episode was produced by Tanya Bustos with special help from J.R. Whalen. John Wardock is the executive producer of WSJ Podcasts. I'm Veronica Dagger. Thanks for listening.
What's your secret? Let us know. Write podcasts@dowjones.com or on Twitter. Use hashtag Secrets of Wealthy Women.
This episode is brought to you by Charles Schwab. Decisions made in Washington can affect your portfolio every day, but what policy changes should investors be watching? Washington Wise is an original podcast for investors from Charles Schwab that unpacks the stories making news in Washington and how they may affect your finances and portfolio. Listen at schwab.com/washingtonwise.